wanna see my picture on the cover. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today we're going to be reading selections from a collector's edition from Rolling Stone, dealing with Mick Jagger's 75th birthday. This is subtitled The Ultimate Guide to His Music and Legend. The first article is by David Fricke. Introduction. Mick Jagger made his debut on the cover of Rolling Stone early in the magazine's life. Issue 15, dated August 10, 1968. The story was a report by founder and editor Jan S. Wenner from a Los Angeles recording studio where the Rolling Stones singer was working on his band's 68 Turning Point, the blues devil uproar of Beggar's Banquet. 4 issues later, Jagger was on the front page again for his first Rolling Stone interview, an in-depth exchange on the Stones' origins, songwriting, and stage mayhem, conducted in London by Jonathan Cott with Sue Cox. Jagger pulled no punches. He dismissed his lyrics to the 1965 single Get Off of My Cloud as crap and responded crisply when Cott brought up the impact of the Stones' initial records, taught purists of American blues and R&B songs, on white American teens. You could say that we did blues to turn people on, Jagger said. But he continued, what's the point in listening to us doing I'm a King Bee when you can listen to Slim Harpo doing it? That issue, with Ethan Russell's cover photo of a relaxed, grinning Jagger, was the first Rolling Stone I ever bought. It was also my introduction to Jagger's straight-shooting judgments and playful, biting wit in conversation. I eventually got to experience those qualities myself in multiple encounters. Starting in 1989, during the London recording sessions for Steel Wheels. They are present on every page in this collection of classic encounters from Jagger's 50 years of thrust and parry in Rolling Stone. Jagger has appeared on the cover more than 24 times so far, 20 times just between 1968 and 1990, more than Paul McCartney and Bob Dylan. Ironically, as Wenner pointed out in the introduction to his historic 1995 Jagger Remembers interview, the most far-reaching and detailed interview ever conducted with the singer, submitting to questioning is one of Jagger's least favorite pastimes. His life has been public for so long, he sees little need to explain or justify himself. Yet Jagger's Rolling Stone interviews, when he gets down to business, have proved to be a vital, expansive forum for artist and reader alike, an open door into his life at historic junctions in the Stones' odyssey. The willingness to challenge myths and misconceptions about his craft and celebrity, his frank assessments of the Stones' biggest hits and occasional misfires, the pointed reflections on his mercurial bond with Keith Richards, the cool certainty of his opinions, leavened with a refusal to take himself too seriously. They are all here, in a dynamic, evolving portrait of Jagger's art and stardom as they happened in the studio and on stage. This is Jagger on Jagger, articulate and candid on the hysteria of the British invasion and the Stones' glorious out-of-control 70s, on the women in Jagger's songs, the solo adventures in the grind and glory of the road, and note the singer's impatience when he is inevitably asked if the next tour is indeed the last time. The first time I answered that was in 1966. It's on film, Jagger responded dryly during the 2005 interview here, when I talked with him at the Toronto rehearsals for the two-hour tour supporting A Bigger Bang. The Stones have been playing around with the world almost every year since. As early as that 1968 interview with Cott, Rolling Stone acknowledged how elusive Jagger could be. Someday the rest will be filled in, the magazine promised. But in the meantime, it's a pleasure to present this as a starter. That conversation continues. Here is the best of it, for now. Our next article is entitled Pleased to Meet You. In 1968, after a drug bust and a psychedelic detour, Mick Jagger talked with Rolling Stone for the first time, just before the Beggar's Banquet hit shelves. This is by Jonathan Cott with Sue Cox. It's excerpted from Rolling Stone of October 12, 1968. Although one of the most intelligent performers around, Mick Jagger is also one of the most laconic. Since the departure of Andrew Lug Oldham, the burden of directing the affairs of the Stones has fallen on Mick, leaving him little time for much else. This interview was completed in June at the Rolling Stones business offices in London. Although not the most complete set of questions and answers, it is nonetheless the most extensive discussion yet available with Jagger about the Stones. The first thing we would like to talk about is your old songs, like Poison Ivy, Route 66. Why did you choose that type of material in the beginning? Well, I mean, we were kids, you know, just kids. We did everything, and that was a groove. You see, Poison Ivy was unknown in this country. It wasn't a hit here by the Coasters, and other songs like Money were totally unheard of. It wasn't released in America, it was put out in England. It was a very early recording with three other things, an EP. Right. Bye Bye Johnny and Better Move On, that was the second version. Like, I'm a King Bee? Well, that was pretty unheard of in America. What I mean is, there were a lot of these hit records in the States that nobody knew about here. We did them. And after, we thought they weren't good. But at the time, it was right. But the Stones made these songs popular. No, not really. Everybody did those kinds of songs. The Beatles, the Hollies, the Searchers, everyone. Isn't it true that with songs like Come On and King Bee, you really rediscovered Slim Harpo and Chuck Berry for a lot of Americans who never listened to that kind of music before? Yeah. They never knew anything about it, and that's why we stopped doing blues. We didn't want to do blues forever. We wanted to turn people on to other people who were very good. So you could say that we did blues to turn people on. But why they should be turned on by us is unbelievably stupid. What's the point in listening to us doing I'm a King Bee when you can listen to Slim Harpo doing it? At that time, did you think you were going to be a writer and get into all your own things as you have? No, I really didn't think about that much. Your change in style came about when you thought enough people had been turned on to blues? I think our change came about the same time a lot of the beat groups started, when there were no hit groups and the Beatles were playing the Cavern. We were blues purists, who liked ever-so commercial things but never did them on stage because we were so horrible and so aware of being blues purists. You see, nobody knew each other in those days. We didn't know the Beatles and the Animals and the this and the that and the other group, yet we were all doing the same material. We used to be so surprised to hear other people do the same thing we were doing. What was the first thing you wrote? The first thing was Tell Me. Well, that wasn't the first thing we wrote, but it was one of the first things we recorded that we had written. Also, As Tears Go By, That Girl Belongs to Yesterday, which was a hit here by Gene Pitney. We were writing ballads. Don't ask me why. How did you come to record I Want to Be Your Man, the Beatles thing? Well, we knew them by then, and we were rehearsing, and Andrew brought Paul and John down to the rehearsal. They said they had this tune. They were really hustlers then. I mean, the way they used to hustle tunes was great. Hey, Mick, we've got this great song, done with a John Lennon accent. So Paul and John played it, and we thought it sounded pretty commercial, which is what we were looking for. So we did it like Elmore James or something. I haven't heard it for ages, but it must be pretty freaky because nobody really produced it. The guy who happened to be our manager at the time was a 50-year-old Northern Mill owner named Eric Easton. It was completely crackers, but it was a hit and sounded great on stage. What happened during the time between that and Satisfaction? That's a lot of time. I don't know what happened. You say, I Want to Be Your Man, and I'd forgotten about it. Next came As Tears Go By. We never dreamed of doing that ourselves when we wrote it. We just gave it to Marianne Faithfull. We wrote a lot of songs for other people, most of which were very unsuccessful. Did you write As Tears Go By specifically for Marianne Faithfull? Yeah, but I could never do it again. I keep trying night after night. Then we did Not Fade Away and went to America, and that was really a change. How did that affect you? Well, we started going back to blues a bit more. I remember we went to Chess Recording Studios and recorded all the old blues numbers we used to do, a lot of which have never been released. Who was doing your production then? Andrew? Yeah, but he didn't know anything about the blues. The cat who really got it together was Ron Marlowe, the engineer for Chess. He had been on all the original sessions. We did Confessing the Blues, Down the Road a Piece, and It's All Over Now. Murray the K gave us It's All Over Now, which was great because we used to think he was a cunt. But he turned us on to something good. It was a great record by the Valentinos, but it wasn't a hit. That was when you first ran into censorship problems with the words half-assed games. Many of the disc jockeys in the States just cut that part out. Did they really? I didn't know that. I really don't know what's considered rude in America, because it's all so different, isn't it? Here, you can use Americanisms, and people don't know what you're saying. Censorship is weird. Even though you had several hits before Satisfaction was really the turn-on for a vast majority of people, was there any specific incident that brought those lyrics to you? It was Keith, really. I mean, it was his initial idea. It sounded like a folk song when we first started working on it, and Keith didn't like it very much. He didn't want it to be a single. He didn't think it would do very well. That was the only time we've had a disagreement. Even when it was finished, he didn't like it? I think Keith thought it was just a bit too basic. I don't think he really listened to it properly. He was too close to it and just felt it was a silly kind of riff. Did you think Satisfaction would become the number one pop song of this era, as it has? Nope, not at all. Did you think about the problem of writing a follow-up? No, I didn't give a fuck. We knew it wouldn't be as good, but so what? Where were you when you wrote it? Tampa, Florida, by a swimming pool. Did you do a lot of your writing on tour? Oh yeah, always. It's the best place to write because you're just totally into it. You get back from a show, have something to eat, a few beers, and just go to your room and write. I used to write about 12 songs in 2 weeks on tour. It gives you lots of ideas. At home, it's very different because you don't want to do anything really but read and things like that. I'd like to ask you a personal question about Play With Fire. There are lines about getting your kicks in Knightsbridge and Stepney. And there are lines about a rich girl and her father's away, and there's a suggestion that the guy in the song is having an affair, not only with the daughter, but with the mother as well. Ah, the imagination of teenagers. Well, one always wants to have an affair with one's mother. I mean, it's a turn-on. Oftentimes when you record, you mumble your lyrics. Is this done purposely as a style? That's when the bad lines come up. I mean, I don't think the lyrics are that important. I remember when I was very young, I read an article by Fats Domino, which has really influenced me. He said, "You should never sing the lyrics out very clearly." You can really hear, "I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill." Exactly, but that's the only thing you can hear, just like you hear, "I can't get no satisfaction." It's true what he said, though. I used to have great fun deciphering lyrics. I don't try to make them so obscure that nobody can understand, but on the other hand, I don't try not to. I just do it as it comes. For some reason, people don't think about the fact that you and Keith are great writers, and your lyrics like Get Off of My Cloud, which are really good. Oh, they're not. They're crap. Union Jacks and Windscreens? It's a nice poem. It's nothing. Thank you for the compliment, but I don't think they're that great at all. If a person is that hung up on lyrics, he can go and buy the sheet music because it's all there. All wrong, of course. But you should see the one for Dandelion. They made up another song. How did you feel when you went on the Ed Sullivan Show and had to change the lyrics from Let's Spend the Night Together to Let's Spend Some Time Together? I never said time. I really didn't. I said mumble. Let's spend some moon together. They would have cut it off if I had said night. When you first came to San Francisco in 1965, the Diggers put out a proclamation calling the Stones the embodiment of what they represented, the breaking up of old values. This came about after a series of songs like 19th Nervous Breakdown, Mother's Little Helper, Have You Seen Your Mother? Have You Seen Your Mother was like the ultimate freakout. We came to a full stop after that. I just couldn't make it with that anymore. What more could we say? But obviously these songs bothered people because for the first time rock songs were saying things that couldn't be said before. Not just on a sex level, like old blues tunes, I'll squeeze your lemon till the juice runs down your leg. You don't get close to things like that, but what you said was strong. I like that one very much. We used to do it. It's spending all that time in America. All these songs were written in America. It's a great place to write because all the time you're being bombarded with all of it, and you can't help but try and put it in some kind of form. I think the Mothers of Invention do it so well. You could never be the Mothers if you lived here. You just couldn't. It's all here as well, but not so obvious. As far as I'm concerned, those songs just reflect what's going on. What about people who see your songs as political or sociological statements? Well, it's interesting, but it's just the Rolling Stones sort of rambling on about what they feel. But no other group seems to do that. Yeah, they do, lots of groups. What other groups ever wrote a song like 19th Nervous Breakdown or Mother's Little Helper? Well, Bob Dylan. That's not really the same thing. Dylan once said, I could have written Satisfaction, but you couldn't have written Tambourine Man. He said that to you? No, to Keith. What did he mean? He wasn't putting you down, was he? Oh yeah, of course he was. But that was just funny. It was great. That's what he's like. It's true, but I'd like to hear Bob Dylan sing I Can't Get No Satisfaction. Did you like Otis Redding's version? Yeah, I dug it, but not, well, I dug it. I think it's great, because it's sort of, no, I'm not going to say. Well, the sounds were great, and he was great when he first started off singing, but then it sort of went into ooh, ah, gotta, gotta, gitta, which is great, because that's his scene, but I like Aretha Franklin's better. I was very turned on that Otis cut it. Your songs about girls like Out of Time, Please Go Home, Gotta Get Away, Yesterday's Papers, Lady Jane, and many more like Backstreet Girl seem rather bitter and mean, whereas She Smiled Sweetly, Ruby Tuesday, Like a Rainbow, are all about mystical girls. Different girls. I don't know what to say except they speak for themselves. They're all very unthought-out songs. I write them, and they are never looked at again. But it sounds as though you mean it all the time. Well, I do. That's the scene. Those songs reflect the day and a few stupid chicks getting on my nerves. Lady Jane is a very weird song. I don't really know what it's all about myself. All the names are historical, but it was really unconscious that they should fit together from the same period. Did you ever feel guilty about getting on stage and pointing to those little girls and singing, Everybody Needs Somebody, when you really don't want them at all? Of course I want them. Satanic Majesties is probably the most controversial LP you've had. People either hated it or loved it. It seems to be a personal statement rather than a collection of songs. What were your original ideas about putting it together? None at all. Absolutely no idea behind it. No, it's wrong to say there is this or no idea at all. There was, but it was all completely external. It was done over such a long period of time that eventually it just evolved. The first thing we did was She's a Rainbow, then 2,000 Light Years from Home, then Citadel, and it just got freakier as we went along. Then we did Sing This Song All Together, and on with the show. The Lantern, and then Bill's One in Another Land. It took almost a year to make, not because it's so fantastically complex that we needed a whole year, but because we were so strung out. That was the year in which several arrests were made. Yeah, that took a lot of time, plus we didn't know if we had a producer or not. Sometimes Andrew would turn up, sometimes he wouldn't. We never knew if we would be in jail or what. Keith and I never sat down and played the songs to each other. We just made that album for what it was. Were you happy when it was finished? I was happy, yeah. I breathed a sigh of relief because we'd really finished it. It's just there to take it or leave it. Were any of the songs written after your or Brian's arrest? I'm very conscious of the fact that it doesn't reflect that in any of the songs, that they aren't about policemen as they could well have been. But it is an album like Aftermath is an album, but December's Children isn't. It's just a collection of songs. Is there any one album you consider your best? Well, no. I like our first album very much because it's all the stuff we used to do on stage. Then I like Aftermath because I like the songs, although I don't like the way some of them were done. Going back to Satanic Majesties for a minute, I've noticed that there seems to be a constant mood of sleeping and dreaming throughout the whole thing. I read somewhere else that it was supposed to be about traveling, which is weird too, because it's when you come to look at it the other way. You heard what? Dreaming and waking up? I don't know. Maybe it is. That's great if you get that from it. That's fantastic. There also seem to be certain words that constantly reappear like ritual objects. For instance, light, high, and flower. I don't know what to think about it. It's very weird, really, and doesn't have anything to do with me. It hasn't got any sort of songs in it. All the words are very obscure. No, they aren't really. 2,000 Light Years isn't. That is my favorite, but it's lousy in stereo. Did you feel that Satanic was your first attempt at the Strawberry Fields type of music? Well, it's a very heady album, very spaced out. What can we expect from your new LP, Beggar's Banquet? Jumpin' Jack Flash is the most basic thing we've done this time, although that may or may not be in the album. There are a couple country tunes. We've always liked country music. Have you been influenced by the Byrds and Dylan with their country bands? Yeah, but Keith has always been country. That's what his scene was. We still think of country songs as a bit of a joke, I'm afraid. We don't really know anything about country music, really. We were just playing games. We aren't really into it enough to know. I guess it's going to be a good album. You're getting into films now, aren't you? Yeah, well, you can do a lot with film. What's it like to work with Jean-Luc Godard, the director? I don't know him very well. Godard is a very nice man. I mean, I've seen all his pictures, and I think they're groovy. What is 1 plus 1, the original title for Godard's Sympathy for the Devil, about? I have no idea, really. I know he's shooting with color film used by astronauts when re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. I mean, he's completely freaky. I think the idea for the movie is great, but I don't think it will be the same when it's finished. What is the idea Godard has told you? Well, it's his, Godard's wife, who plays the lead chick. She comes to London and gets totally destroyed with some spade cat. Gets involved with drugs or something. Anyway, while she's getting destroyed, we find the Rolling Stones freaking out at the recording studio making these sounds. Godard happened to catch us on two very good nights. He might have come every night for 2 weeks and just seen us looking at each other with blank faces. and it would have been the same side of the coin as the chick destroying herself and us sitting there looking bored. One night, he got us going over and over this song called Sympathy for the Devil. It started out as a folksy thing like Jigsaw Puzzle, but that didn't make it, so we kept going over it until finally it comes out as a samba. So Godard has the whole thing from beginning to end. That's something I've always wanted to do on film. It's probably boring to most people, but when he's finished cutting it, it will be great. Do you find it difficult not having any privacy? Difficult? No, it's really nice and easy. The only hang-up is the fuzz. Now that's a drag. Once you get in trouble with the police, you're always in trouble, and that's it. Before, we were never in trouble, and they were always very nice to us. They should be looking after people and turning American tourists away from Piccadilly Circus. That's the only hang-up, but it doesn't have anything to do with me. Do you feel the police made an effort to pick on the Stones? Well, there always has been. But for all the hassle, it was just the boring newspapers. But when the fuzz started getting into that, it can be very draggy. They have the wherewithal to do it to you if they want to. The newspapers can only scream from their drunken haunts, like the Wig and Feather Club, but they can't do anything. The police can. The next article is entitled Road to Exile. As life in England drew to a close for the Rolling Stones, Jagger showed how much he cared, and how much he didn't. This is by Robert Greenfield, and it's excerpted from Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile, 2014. March 1971. Although Sticky Fingers will not be released for another 7 weeks, Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones are touring Great Britain. With no security whatsoever, they're traveling by train and bus to do 2 shows a night in aging town halls and crumbling theaters that barely seat 2,000 people, so they can perform unreleased songs like Bitch, Brown Sugar, and Dead Flowers. For Mick and the Stones, this is both the best of times and the worst of times. Only recently, they have finally freed themselves from the clutches of manager Alan Klein, as well as from the onerous recording contract they signed so long ago with Decca. The good news is that the Stones' new album will be released on a label of its own, overseen by Marshall Chess, which will be distributed by Atlantic Records. With the Beatles having broken up just a year earlier, the Stones are now the center of the rock and roll universe. The bad news is that a recent audit of their always chaotic finances has revealed that not only are the Stones broke, they also owe so much money in back taxes that once this tour is over, they will have to leave England to live as tax exiles in the south of France. At the time, I understand none of this. Not yet 25 years old, I've been laboring happily as a correspondent in the London office of Rolling Stone for the past 6 months, without ever having been on the road with any band, much less the mighty Rolling Stones. Nor have I ever seen them perform live. Despite this conspicuous lack of credentials, I have been handed the enviable job of covering their farewell tour of Great Britain from the inside out. As an ardent practitioner of new journalism, I intend to observe and record everything that happens on the tour without influencing events in any way. And so I decide to never take notes where anyone can see me doing so. In the end, this results in my spending more time writing in my notebook in freezing cold, filthy lavatories than I care to remember. And so, imbued with the spirit of true adventure and a vague sense that my life is about to change in ways I could not then imagine, I board the noon train from King's Cross Station to Newcastle, where the Stones will kick off the tour that night. While I am delighted that no one seems to have the faintest idea who I am or what I am doing on this tour, Mick Jagger himself is nowhere to be seen. When Mick finally arrives in Newcastle shortly before the show, he is accompanied by the current love of his life, the astonishingly beautiful and very mysterious Bianca Perez Mora Macias. Although no one around the Stones knows this at the time, Bianca is already 2 months pregnant with the couple's daughter, Jade. In 2 months, Bianca and Mick will be married in what many dub the wedding of the year, if not the century, in oh-so-fashionable Saint-Tropez. Making a fashion statement of major proportions, Mick sports a knee-length leather maxi-coat with a huge fur collar. Around his neck hangs a long tasseled scarf. By his side, Bianca is resplendent in a snow-white linen cape. Both have chosen to accessorize their outfits with oversized and somewhat outlandish wide-brimmed hats. Sitting in a pink sateen suit and a multicolored jockey's cap an hour later, staring into the mirror while applying cream to his face in the band's dressing room, Mick, then only 27, looks oddly frail and very pale. All this changes after he leads the band on stage and kicks off the set with Jumpin' Jack Flash. The Stones then go into Live With Me, followed by a new song, Dead Flowers. Sitting beside Mick on a wooden stool, bathed in a purple spotlight, Keith Richards picks out a perfect acoustic version of Robert Johnson's Love in Vain, followed by Robert Wilkins' Prodigal Son. The night's tone shifts again with Midnight Rambler, which starts with 6 to 12 bars of basic blues before Keith slings one guitar off over his head and slips another on, tuning it so he can launch into the song's menacing central riff. After the first four verses, everything slows down an ominous crawl. With just Bill Wyman's bass pulsing away, the lights go blue and eerie on Mick's face. Taking off his studded black belt, he falls to his knees and begins crooning, "Beggin' with you, baby, go down on me, baby, uh-huh." Suddenly, Mick has managed to transform himself from a rock star into the murderous villain who happens to be the hero of this piece. Rising to his feet in a slow and decidedly sinister manner, Mick dangles the belt behind his shoulder. As he slashes the belt down on the stage, band comes in behind him and all the lights go blood red in his face. As one, the entire crowd lets out a gasp. Mick prowls the edge of the stage, hunched over like an evil old man. After the song crashes to a conclusion, each and every member of the audience is on their feet, screaming for more. The Stones tear right into another new song, Bitch. Stepping up to the microphone, Mick says, "And now a song for all the horrors in the audience." After the Stones rip through Honky Tonk Women, they launch into a long, unrecognizable introduction that becomes Satisfaction. Solidly crazed by what it is now hearing, the crowd in Newcastle starts rocking down the aisles. Middle-aged ladies in toreador pants, who seem to have come straight out of 1957, bump obscenely to the beat as skinheads in Ben Sherman polo shirts, neatly pressed jeans, and black Doc Martens idiot dance in the balcony. Chuck Berry's Little Queen is followed by the soon-to-be-released Brown Sugar, and then Street Fightin' Man. At its climax, Mick flings a wicker basket filled with yellow daffodils into the house. As the final chords ring out and petals slowly come floating down through the spotlight beams, Mick leaps 4 feet in the air and screams. Amazingly, the second show of the night is even better than the first. At 2 a.m, Mick sits at the head of a long table set for dinner with Bianca. Despite having just flown in from New York earlier that day, Marshall Chess, whose father and uncle founded the legendary Chicago record label bearing the family name, is working Mick for all he is worth so the Stones' new album can be released on time. "More than 20 minutes on a side and you lose level," he tells Mick. "You know that. It's how they cut the grooves, so we have to work out the running order." Although Mick may be listening, there's no way to say for sure. As the wine flows and the dinner winds on, Marshall simply refuses to give up. "Will you do it that way, Mick?" he asks. "Will you? If we cut Moonlight Mile to 4 verses and make up a running order so the guy in the States can get started on the sleeves?" It's now 4 a.m, and Mick has his head down, talking to Bianca in a voice only she can hear. When he finally lifts his head, he looks more than a little glazed. From his blank expression, it seems plain that he has not heard a single word Marshall has said to him in the past 10 minutes. Having already done 2 shows tonight, Mick is now being asked to make a decision that will affect not only the release of the new album, but the future of the band as well. Looking very much like an English schoolboy at the end of a very long and trying day, he says, "What, Marshall?" It's Saturday night in Coventry, the picturesque city in the West Midlands where the Luftwaffe bombed St. Michael's Cathedral to ruins during World War II. Wearing a black and white check jacket, Mick sits quietly at a table in a restaurant between shows with his hands folded before him, drinking red wine. As a young woman whom no one seems to know is hustled away through the front door, she cries out, "Forget my name, you bastard! You and all your Rolling Stones!" Taking a sip of wine, Mick says, "Boring, isn't it?" Beside him, Bianca is talking about going gambling somewhere later this evening. Long after everyone else went to bed last night in Manchester, Mick, Bianca, and Marshall found themselves in a casino where the dealer only let them lose, and Mick dropped about £300, a sum Keith will later laughingly estimate is about half his total earnings from this tour. "Ah," Marshall says, "that dealer was terrible. But if we had won, we'd all be saying how good he was, wouldn't we, Mick?" After pausing to think about it, Mick says, "I don't care." A long moment of silence grows and grows. Slowly it dawns on everyone at the table that in terms of his gambling losses, as well as so much else that is now going on around him on this tour, Mick simply does not care. Leaning forward, Bianca asks him, "Tu vas changer le choix?" Which means, "Are you going to change the choice?" If ever there was a time for Mick to consider altering the Stones set list, this would be it. Performing before a young and strangely quiet audience earlier, he did all he could to get the crowd on its feet, but the response was so muted at the end of Street Fighting Man, Mick did not even bother to throw his basket of flowers into the house. His mind already on something else, he looks at Bianca and says, "Choix de quoi?" Which means the choice of what. "De quoi, de quoi?" she answers with a laugh. Having definitely had one drink too many tonight, one of the band's ladies wobbles a bit as she passes by the table. "Drunken bitch," Mick says. "She won't lose weight that way, will she?" Sighing as he did before, he says, "Nothing to do but bitch, is there?" Getting to his feet, Ian Stewart, the Stones' original piano player and longtime road manager, looks at Mick and says, "Come on then, intermission's over." Showing some real emotion for the first time, Mick says, "No, don't wanna." "Oh, fucking why? They sold all the tickets here in 3 hours, and then they just sat there." Walking over to the table, Charlie Watts does a little soft shoe routine that makes Mick smile. He says, "Let's go out there and tread the boards then, Mick." "Yeah," he says, "a tap dance. Oh, it's all right. But why do they just have to sit there?" "Let's go then. We'll do the same show. But if it's the same audience, we'll knock out a number and go home early, eh?" The second show is a drop-dead killer. With the lights green and purple in their faces, Mick and the band incite the crowd to a near riot. As Charlie cooks like crazy, Mick puts the microphone between his legs and bends over so far during Midnight Rambler that his forehead actually touches the stage. Out in the house, everyone sweats and dances and goes home happy. Welcome to Glasgow, a city so drab that it makes Manchester seem like Paris. As everyone boards the bus that will take them from the one and only flight of the tour to the hall, Mick decides to sit beside me. Looking very French, he wears a tightly ribbed sweater and a long, brushed suede maxi coat with a sheepskin lining and collar. Perched back atop his long flowing hair, his plaid woolen cap looks like a beret. In a rambling rap that goes in all directions at once, Mick starts telling me about the mystical aspects of Stonehenge and Glastonbury, and about the time he recently spent in Bali, which is a total culture for the arts, where a whole village will stay up all night for an opera or a ballet. Bizarre as this seems, Mick and I then launch into a long and involved conversation in fairly rapid-fire French. When I ask him how he learned to speak the language, he replies, "En l'école, in school, en France un peu, in France a bit, et avec ma jeune fille, and with my girl." Talking about Bianca, as she herself never does, Mick tells me she has lived all over the world since she was 15, and has spent time in France, Japan, Hawaii, and Canada. When I finally break down and ask him a question about music, he responds, "Oh, who listens to Chuck Berry anymore? I mean, I haven't listened to that stuff for years. Rock and roll has always been made by white suburban bourgeoisie like Elton John. For God's sake, I listen to the MC5. I don't like to see one thing end until I see another one beginning. Like, for instance, breaking up with a woman. Do you know what I mean? In truth, I have no idea. But I'm not about to admit that." Suddenly getting to his feet as the bus rolls to a stop, Mick says, "I'm going to have to sit you down sometime so we can have a long rap about ballet." And then, just as quickly as he appeared by my side, he hops off the bus and is gone. At Liverpool's Lime Street station, Mick steps off the train looking like an altar boy with his hair cut short. Although the storied Empire Theater is just a half block away, and he could easily walk there, it is still far too early for him to appear at the hall. With Bianca by his side, Mick instead slides into the back seat of a long black limo that takes them to the old dark cavernous hotel where, along with everyone else on the tour, they will spend the rest of the day waiting for Keith to appear. An hour after the first show is scheduled to begin, Keith bursts through the dressing room door. Without bothering to offer a single word of explanation about where he's been, he looks around the room and asks, "Is there anything to smoke?" Slouched on a couch next to Bianca in the far corner, Mick answers the question by quietly saying, "We have to go on. They've been waiting." In his voice, there is a truly remarkable lack of emotion. Having been through all of this many times before with Brian Jones, Mick is not about to offer any kind of judgment about Keith's behavior or let him know just how worried about him some people have been all day. In situations like this, that is simply not what Mick does. And while everyone would love to know where the hell Keith has been, this is neither the time nor the place to ask that particular question. For reasons that may have nothing to do with Keith's last-minute arrival, the Stones go on to do the only truly ordinary show of the tour. In the dressing room after it's over, a disconsolate Bill Wyman says, "I just want everyone to say it was shit. They queued for 5 hours, end." Putting an end to the conversation as only he can, Mick says, "I don't care. I don't give a shit. Well, when I'm on stage, maybe, but I'm off now and that's all I care about." Getting to his feet, he slowly walks out of the room. 5 minutes later, as I'm making my way up a backstage staircase in search of a restroom, I nearly trip over Mick. Looking very much like a lovelorn high school kid, he is sitting on a landing as Bianca holds him tightly in her arms. The scene is so intensely personal that I turn around and go right back the way I've come. That's when I realize just how very much Mick still cares about the music. On Sunday in London, everyone lucky enough to have gotten a ticket to see the final two shows of the tour washes their hair and then stands in the long, curling line that winds its way around the roundhouse on Chalk Farm Road. Backstage, a freak show of major proportions is underway, packed so tightly that they might as well be standing on the tube during rush hour. 42 people jam the Stones' dressing room. This scene is such a groupie's who's who of rock superstardom that no one can be bothered to eat or drink a thing. Although the first show of the night leaves nothing to be desired, the audience is so hip and spaced out that people dance only because they think they are supposed to. Minding my own business, I am standing in the far corner of the dressing room during the intermission when Mick comes up to me for what I assume will be just another friendly little chat. Leaning forward until his face is inches from mine, he flashes me a truly chilling smile and says, "You've been as stoned as anyone on this tour, haven't you?" Not about to deny the obvious, I laugh and say, "Yeah, well, I guess that might be true." Pressing on with this line of inquiry like a prosecutor at the Old Bailey, Mick says, "You haven't even taken a single bloody note, have you?" Not about to tell him about all the foul-smelling lavatories in which I've filled countless pages with notes over the past 10 days, I laugh again and mumble an incoherent reply. Mick sneers at me like I have just proved his point, and then he says, "The real truth is, you've got no bloody idea at all what's happened on this tour, have you?" Not about to get into it with Mick Jagger in the Stones dressing room before the final show of the tour, I stand there without uttering a single word in my defense. Nor would it have done me any good to do so. For what Mick was really doing was rattling my cage as loudly as he could to see how I would react. As I would later learn, nearly everyone who had not been around the Stones since the beginning had to pass through Mick's burning ring of fire. If you could do so without exploding into flames, you could continue your association with him and the band. If not, the Stones would just move on without you, as they already had done countless times. For me, the good news was that when my article appeared in Rolling Stone 3 weeks later, I somehow managed to pass the test with flying colors. 2 weeks after the last show of the tour, the Stones decide to put the frosting on their own going-away cake by holding a very private, invitation-only party at a small, fashionable hotel located on the banks of the River Thames in Maidenhead, just 40 minutes by train from London. With vintage champagne flowing freely from the bar, 200 people crowd a ballroom where weddings and tea dances are usually held. Although John Lennon, Yoko Ono, Eric Clapton, Roger Daltrey, and Stephen Stills are all there, Keith is nowhere to be seen. Considering the wild spirit of abandon everyone has brought with them tonight, this proves to be a blessing in disguise for all concerned. As loud music plays over the public address system, everyone begins getting so drunk that the roadie assigned to set off fireworks down by the river somehow manages to set himself on fire instead and has to be rolled in the grass to put out the flames. Needless to say, the party roars on without him. Around 2 in the morning, the powers that be decide the time has come to shut down the music, and the PA goes dead without any warning. Wandering around the ballroom in a somewhat altered state, Bianca starts protesting what has just happened. Getting into it as well, Mick loudly demands to know why the music has stopped. After having been told it was done to comply with a local ordinance, he decides to demonstrate his displeasure with this decision by flinging a chair through one of the large plate glass windows overlooking the river. And so it is with a loud crashing sound that reverberates in the ballroom as the chair goes careening through the window that this chapter in the always astonishing history of Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones comes to a shattering but utterly appropriate end. For better and for worse, the Rolling Stones are now about to leave the land of their birth and embark on what they will soon discover is, in fact, the long and winding road to exile. For Mick and the Stones, nothing will be as it was. And yet, despite it all, the music will never stop. The next article is entitled Girls Talk. We probably won't get through this entire article in the time remaining, so we'll continue it in our next recording. Jagger knew Some Girls was the band's best album in years. He also knew it would stir up some controversy. This by Jonathan Cott. "I've been missing the Rolling Stones for years, ever since they released Exile on Main Street, as a matter of fact. During their post-exile period, the Stones seemed to have been around more in body than spirit. In their original 60s incarnation, the Rolling Stones presented an eerie quality that combined the hustling menace of the Spiv, the coolness of the Dandy, and the unpredictable amorality and frivolity of the Greek gods. And in such a guise, they exuberantly took on the role of devil's advocate for what was then beginning to be thought of as the love generation, ridiculing the vices and hypocrisies of family and social life in songs like 19th Nervous Breakdown and Mother's Little Helper. But the Stones didn't stop there. Unassimilable voices of disengagement, they attacked the vice of the spirit of society itself in such songs as Sympathy for the Devil and 2000 Man. Oh, Daddy, is your brain still flashing like it did when you were young? Or did you come down crashing, seeing all the things you done? Oh, it's a big put-on. As spoken and sung by their shining and narcissistic knight, Mick Jagger, the Rolling Stones presented themselves as beings of exalted indifference, innocent malice, careless cruelty. It was these ambiguous mixtures of emotions that one found in such songs as Play with Fire, Backstreet Girl, and Star Star, a mixture revealing the disturbing yet fascinating quality of a child grown up too soon, like a six-year-old dragging on a cigarette. And it was this child who dangerously explored the ever-lurking but disapproved world of sex and drugs in such songs as Under My Thumb, Sister Morphine, and Monkey Man. It's exactly this kind of playful yet powerful ambiguity that I have missed in the Stones' work during the recent, musically dispiriting past few years. But now we have Some Girls, an album that draws on, in a remarkably unhackneyed way, the Stones' love for blues, the Motown sound, for country music, and Chuck Berry. And it's an album that thematically crystallizes the Stones' perennial obsession with some girls, both real and imaginary. After years of standing in the shadows, the sole survivors are back on their own, with no direction home, sounding just like the Rolling Stones. The following interview with Mick Jagger took place during two evenings in late April and early May at Rolling Stones Records in New York. Along with The Who, the Rolling Stones are one of the last 60s English rock groups that are still together. I think both groups are very fragile. There are rumors that the Rolling Stones will break up very soon. That's rubbish. They said it in 1969, too. They say it all the time. Both groups are fragile because they've got problems of various kinds. The Who's are different from ours. In our case, if Keith gets put into prison, it makes the future of our band a bit shaky. I mean, he goes on trial October 21st, and you know what the charge is. Peddling heroin, which is punishable by life imprisonment. Maybe we can start talking about Miss You, which you've released in three versions. A 45 disc, an LP track, and a 12-minute version, on which there's a fantastic harmonica solo by a guy named Sugar Blue, who plays like a snake charmer. Yeah, Sandy Whitelaw discovered him playing in the Paris Metro. He's a blues harpist from America, and he plays not only in the subways, but in a club called La Vieille Grille. He's a very strange and talented musician. The lines in the song about being called up at midnight by friends wanting to drag you out to a party remind me of Get Off of My Cloud. I've a limited number of ideas, he laughs. And I like the line, you've been the star in all my dreams. Dreams are like movies in a way, or movies are like dreams. You once sang, I only get my rocks off while I'm dreaming. I don't dream more than anybody else. But dreams are a great inspiration for the lowliest rock and roll writer to the greatest playwright. Chaucer was a great one for dreams. He was a great one for explaining them and making fun of the astrological explanations. He used to take the piss out of most of them, but some of them he took seriously. Shakespeare, too, knew a lot about early English witchcraft and religion, and Chaucer had some sort of similar knowledge. Today we have psychiatrists to interpret dreams. Have you ever been to one? Never. Not once. I've read a lot of Jung, and I would have gone to see him because he was interesting. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, dreams are very important, and I get good ideas from them. I don't jot them down. I just remember them, the experiences of them. They're so different from everyday experiences. But the line in Rocks Off is really a joke. How about the beautiful line, I'm hiding sister and I'm dreaming, from Midnight Mile? Yeah, that's a dream song. Those kinds of songs with dreamy sounds are fun to do, but not all the time. It's nice to come back to reality. What about the girl with faraway eyes on your new album? And the lines, and if you were downright disgusted and life ain't worth a dime, get a girl with faraway eyes, make it sound as if this dreamy truck stop girl from Bakersfield, California, is really real. Yeah, she's real. She's a real girl. Is she a girl you know? Yeah, she's right across the room, a little bleary-eyed. Well, there's no one else here except for that poster of a Japanese girl. Is that whom you mean? No, she's not in a truck stop. Right. She's standing under a parasol, in fact. Let me have another glass of wine, and maybe I'll see her, too. You know when you drive through Bakersfield on a Sunday morning or Sunday evening? I did that about 6 months ago. All the country music radio stations start broadcasting live from L.A. Black Gospel Services. And that's what the song refers to. But the song's really about driving alone, listening to the radio. I sense a Graham Parsons feeling on Faraway Eyes. Country music has transformed through his style, via Buck Owens. I knew Graham quite well, and he was one of the very few people who really helped me to sing country music. Before that, Keith and I used to copy it off records. I used to play piano with Graham, and on Faraway Eyes, I'm playing piano, though Keith is actually playing the top part. We added it on after. But I wouldn't say this song was influenced specifically by Graham. That idea of country music played slightly tongue-in-cheek. Graham had that in Drugstore Truck Driving Man, and we have that sardonic little quality, too. The title of your new album is the title of one of the most powerful and outrageous songs, Some Girls. I wanted to ask you about some of the girls in your songs. Here are a few lines taken at random from several of your older albums. Who's that woman on your arm, all dressed up to do you harm, from Let It Loose? Women think I'm tasty, but they're always trying to waste me, from Tumbling Dice. But there is one thing I will never understand, some of the sick things a girl does to a man, from Sitting on a Fence. I didn't write all those lines, you know. He laughs. That's all the time we have for this week. We will continue this interview in the next recording session. This is Dan Klingel, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Rolling Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover. Stone.